From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, more about the Doors from the man who has sent the bills for Jim Morrison's damages in the studio and on tour. We talk with Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records. He's written a new book about the record label, which first made its mark with such folk musicians as Gene Ritchie, Tom Paxton, Phil Oakes, and Judy Collins. Also, we talk with a pioneer of split brain research, Dr. Michael Gazzaniga. His new book is about how the mind interprets the past. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Lucinda Williams' new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Two U.S. Border Patrol agents have been shot and killed today, and a Texas sheriff's deputy is critically wounded. The agents were killed after a shootout in San Benito, Texas, with a man who then barricaded himself in an isolated ranch house. A second suspect has been taken into custody. The slayings occurred as the suspects were fleeing from another shooting. The agents joined Texas authorities trying to nab them. The last time a Border Patrol agent was killed in the line of duty in Texas was January 1996. A retired two-star general who served as the Army's deputy inspector general is being accused of inappropriate or improper behavior with the wives of four of his subordinates. These conclusions are part of a lengthy investigation by the Pentagon inspector general. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
At the time of the alleged offenses, Major General David Hale was the deputy commanding general of Allied land forces in southeastern Europe, based in Turkey. The inspector general's report concludes that during a period from 1996 through 1997, Hale engaged in a pattern of inappropriate behavior, including adultery with the spouse of an Army officer who served on Hale's staff, and improper relationships with three other wives of former subordinate officers. In addition, the IG's report concludes that Major General Hale sanctioned the misuse of government funds for the spouse's travel and made false and misleading statements concerning his conduct. Hale was allowed to retire honorably in February, although one of the allegations had already been leveled against him. An Army criminal investigation has now begun. Martha Raddatz, NPR News, Washington.
A key witness in the Monica Lewinsky investigation has returned to answer questions before a federal grand jury. Linda Tripp, who has alleged Lewinsky and President Clinton had an affair, is spending her third day before the panel. She's apparently been offering details of her contacts with Lewinsky. Both the president and the former White House intern have denied having an affair, but the grand jury is investigating that and an alleged cover-up. Weather forecasters say rain is expected in Florida and 2 inches of rain could fall. That would be a start toward damping down fires burning in the east and central parts of the state. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE in Orlando says the threat of fires is unabated.
Florida is still dealing with a lot of hot spots. We've had about 476,000 acres of land having been burned since the end of May. In fact, all of the situation has prompted another visit from President Clinton toward Thursday, and this will be the second time this year that he's come down to visit natural disaster sites here in Florida. Back in February, he came down after the killer tornadoes, and now he's coming again to inspect the damage from the wildfires.
Reporter Pat Duggins. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 46 points at 91.38. The NASDAQ is down 3. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, expectations about corporate earnings seem to be what's influencing stocks so far today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Internet stocks have been the big movers on Wall Street this week. On the heels of run-ups yesterday, some of the internet company stocks were actually a bit lower today, though. That includes stock in Yahoo, which weighs in with its latest quarterly earnings report tomorrow. Motorola is also slightly lower ahead of what's expected to be the company's first down quarterly earnings report in more than a decade. Motorola is scheduled to report second quarter earnings after the markets close today. Stock in Gemstar rose on news the company is the object of a hostile takeover bid from United Video Satellite Group. United Video, which recently bought TV Guide, provides satellite television listings to 50 million households. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
At least one insurance company will ignore a request from Florida's insurance commissioner. The state had asked insurers last week to waive fire insurance deductibles and pay for living expenses for all evacuees who stayed in hotels rather than public shelters. Many shelters were overcrowded with the tens of thousands of fire evacuees. Insurance Commissioner Bill Nelson made the request, saying even if insurance policies didn't cover the lodging expenses, they might want to consider that. State Farm Insurance told the Orlando Sentinel customers will still need to pay deductibles as required. Negotiators for General Motors and the United Auto Workers have returned to the bargaining table. GM's labor chief and the UAW's vice president have helped lead discussions. The two strikes at GM parts plants in Flint, Michigan, have idled about 161,000 workers and nearly closed all of GM's North American production. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday on Fresh Air, Ray Manzarek, who was the keyboard player with The Doors, told us a lot of great stories. One of those stories was about how singer Jim Morrison threw a TV at the control room window during The Doors' first recording session. So how did the head of the record company feel about that kind of behavior? Well, we asked Jack Holtzman, the founder of The Doors' record company, Elektra Records. Holtzman has a new book about Elektra called Follow the Music. Elektra started out as a folk and ethnic music label and first made its mark with such performers as Gene Ritchie, Theodore Bikel, Judy Collins, Tom Paxton, and Phil Oakes. Elektra's first big hit was the Doors single Light My Fire. What attracted a folk and classical music fan like Jack Holtzman to the Doors? Well, one thing was their version of the Brecht Weil song Whiskey Bar.
Well, show me the way to the whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you, we must die. Oh, moon of Alabama, now must say
I asked Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records, about the difficulties he faced working with Jim Morrison, who was talented, commercially successful, but often out of control.
From our standpoint, the difficulties in Jim's life and the way he expressed them were nothing as compared to the magic of the recordings. It was more than Light My Fire. The first Doors album was as close to a perfect album as I've ever been involved with. That album really pushed the envelope, and I was just so thrilled to be associated with it. And if there was a price to pay, that was okay with me. I had dealt with some outrageous artists before who had problems, and artists afterwards who had problems. And I found it best to keep my distance because I am the person who runs their record company, and I am the surrogate for the audience. And it's my job to make sure that things keep moving and that the artists are given the very best possible circumstances in which to record. And these are the issues that you have to deal with.
So you try to keep your distance in part so you could remain kind of the authority figure and not get too close with anyone.
Well, it makes it difficult if at some point you have to take a stand on something and you've been hanging out with them all the time. It erodes the special relationship that you have with them. And I think that the Doors appreciated that. I know Jim did. Before he went to Paris, he wanted to have sort of a farewell drinking session with me. Well, I'm smart enough not to have more than two with Jim Morrison because Jim's big enemy was alcohol. and he could be a prince. You could take him anywhere, but pour a few drinks into Jim, and he would go from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, and it was a real problem. So I would never try to match him drink for drink. But I remember this evening so vividly, because we're sitting in this bar, and we've each had our second drink, and Jim begins to taunt me, "Jack, you got to go more out on the edge." And I responded, "Jim, it's great being on the edge. The trick is not to bleed." And he sort of paused for a moment, and then we talked about movies.
Your record company, Elektra, was coordinating the Doors' tours and club dates. How would you deal with it if club owners got scared by Morrison's behavior and they wanted to cancel a date?
That never really happened until after the Miami incident.
When he was accused of exposing himself on stage.
That's correct.
And then what happened? And how did you handle it?
Well, what happened then was that a decency movement began in Florida, and there was a move among concert promoters to cancel Doors dates, and Doors dates were being canceled all over the country, and the Doors were in a major funk over this, as well you might imagine they would be. We just kept our cool, and we kept doing what we were supposed to do, be responsible for their records and supporting the boys wherever we could. There's not a lot you can do.
As the head of the record company, did you ever think, oh, well, maybe I should sit down with Jim Morrison and either try to discipline him or have a little talk with him about controlling himself more?
I thought that was better left to Ray Manzarek and the other members of the group. My function is not to discipline artists. My purpose is to be the midwife to their music, to support them, to help them in what they want to do creatively. If an artist asks me for an opinion, they know they'll always get an honest one. But I didn't think it was my place to get involved in what was essentially an internal group problem. I had seen this before. I had had other artists who had problems, and I always let the groups handle them.
Now, why did you decide to sign the Doors? What appealed to you about their music?
I went to see another group called Love, who was on Elektra. And Arthur Lee, who was the essential linchpin of that group, said, "Stick around for the other group that's on the bottom of the bill." And I did. And I wasn't really very impressed. But there was something about the group that kept bringing me back, and was only later that I figured out what it was. It was a kind of austerity in their musical line. If I were to compare the Doors to architecture, I would say that they were the Bauhaus of 60s rock and roll. And I think that cleanliness of line and the expressive lyrics and the sheer beautiful simplicity of it is what has made the group last for over 30 years.
You were kind of unprepared for the incredible success that their first record had, and you had to call the pressing plants to get more records made very quickly because there was a big demand for them. What impact did that have on the company to have this big, sudden demand?
Well, first of all, it was wonderful, and I smiled so wide that my face hurt. But it was fantastic, because suddenly, after having struggled for 17 years with folk albums and singer-songwriters that had found increasing popularity, I was now riding the tiger. And the company was catapulted into a leading position. People were bringing artists to us. We got a first crack at things. And the logistics of pressing the records was left to my brother Keith, and we had relationships with pressing plants over the country, and we were able to get everything manufactured that we needed. But the important thing was that we were able to attract other artists because we had moved up one order of magnitude, I guess, on the scale of record companies. It was heady stuff.
When you found out about Jim Morrison's death, what responsibilities did you have? Did you have to take care of his personal effects or anything like that?
No. What I had to take care of first was my own emotion. Jim had been so special to me, and the band was phenomenal. And they had played such a vital and pivotal role in the growth of Elektra. Jim had been kind to me and my family. He would remember my son Adam's birthday and bring him a musical instrument and spend time with him. So I had to deal with that, but I also realized that I had to deal with what I thought was going to be a media circus, and indeed it had been for Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. But I was lucky. I had 2 days to prepare. I knew about it on a Monday, and it wasn't public knowledge until Wednesday evening. So I sent my my number two man, Bill Harvey, out to the West Coast. We had press releases prepared. We told the staff at the appropriate time. We had to tell Paul Rothschild, who had been their producer for all of the albums except the final one, L.A. Woman. And we got all of that stuff done. So when the phone call started coming and people wanted the radio interviews, we had determined that we were going to let the Doors do most of the talking, the Doors and Pam, and we would speak only about what their music meant to us and to their fans.
It must have been really interesting to be making records during the psychedelic era. And you were one of the record companies that had what you describe as the company freak. What was the job of the company freak?
The company freak was I led a much more 9-to-5 life, and the company freak sort of took over when I went home. The company freak's job was to be out on the street at all times, interpreting the company to the artists and the public, and giving us feedback as to what was being said. Company freaks were instrumental in getting the Doors' Light My Fire single on that very, very important jukebox at Max's Kansas City. They were out and around and knew what was going on. Now, we had one in New York named Danny Fields, and he was an amazing man and still is. Danny began to take on A&R responsibilities. One of the things that happened at Elektra was that you could take on almost as much responsibility as you were willing to be responsible for. So Danny decided to start doing A&R, and he came up with the MC5 and, almost by accident, Iggy Pop and the Stooges.
In your book, you tell the story of what happened after you signed the MC5, and the MC5 was this, you know, revolutionary singing group that sang songs, you know, against the police and against the war, and used a lot of language that you couldn't say on the radio. For example, that record Kick Out the Jams had the word MF in it. So you had to come up with a creative solution to dealing with the fact that this was going to be unplayable on the radio. So you cut two versions of it, one for radio play, where the word MF was substituted with what? Brothers and Sisters?
Brothers and Sisters.
And
sometimes, unfortunately, in a couple of stores, the boxes were mislabeled.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a store, Nordstrom's, in the Midwest who happened to get the wrong box, and some mother brought the record back in, and Nordstrom sent all the records back. So the MC5 were very, very upset, and they took out an ad in the Detroit Free Press, which is like the underground newspaper, with a big Elektra logo, and it said the F word. I'm sorry, it wasn't Nordstrom's, it was Hudson's. F. Hudson's, and signed my name and the Elektra logo to it. Well, I contacted John Sinclair, the great White Panther, and said, you can't do this, because suddenly Hudson's, in response, were sending back Judy Collins, Theodore Bickel, the Incredible String Band, plus they were sending back all my Nonesuch records. Mozart and Bach and all of his progeny were pouring back into the distributors' doors. And we had a disagreement. Later on, Danny Fields, the company freak, said, in defending the MC5, well, it's okay for Jim Morrison to take out his penis, but it's not okay for the MC5 to take out their ad, which was gloriously incongruous logic. But it was so charming, I just had to laugh. We gave a lot of permission, and we suggested to the MC5 that they might be happier elsewhere. And within 24 hours, they had a new deal with Atlantic, and they went and drove them crazy.
Well, it must have been a thankless job, in a way, to try to run a business when the people who you were signing saw themselves as revolutionaries. And you, of course, were part of the establishment because you were a businessman. So, you know, who needs you, right?
Well, we may have been part of the establishment, and I may have been a businessman, but I was a music lover first. And if it hadn't been for music and a love of music and folk music and a passion for engineering, I would never have gotten involved in this. In 1948, when the LP was invented and inexpensive tape recording became available, it was possible for someone like me to grab his bar mitzvah money and start a record company. Interestingly enough, of the 500 to 600 labels that started at that time, only two survive today, where the thread of continuity has can be determined over the years, and that's Elektra and Atlantic. Elektra took political positions. I was horrified by the war in Vietnam. We took out radio editorials, which I spoke in my own voice. We took out paid ads in magazines. Kent State, I thought, was an abomination. I thought what happened at the 1968 Democratic Convention definitely needed to be addressed. And I thought that we as a label stand for something. And I just wanted to speak out and express my own dismay and outrage.
My guest is Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records. His new book is called Follow the Music. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records, and he's written a memoir called Follow the Music, The Life and High Times of Elektra Records in the Great Years of American Pop Culture. So you started the label in 1950 when you were 19 years old with your bar mitzvah money. How much bar mitzvah money did you get?
Well, I got $300 in my cash, another $300 from a friend who just took his veteran's bonus and he put it into the company. I later bought him out, of course.
So what was your vision for the company at the age of 19?
At the age of 19? Well, my vision for the company was a personal vision. I wanted to make a good record, make enough money to make another good record, and go to the movies. I had no sense that I was going to be building a company this large. But what I wanted to do was to be able to not take crazy risks so I could stay in the game. And I would just follow the music and follow the industry and see where it would take me. I did not have a big vision. It was only later, after I had survived for 10 years, that I realized I might be able to take this someplace interesting. And I never knew where the idea was going to hit me. I remember the evening in 1963 when I was sitting in a restaurant waiting for someone, and I was right across the street from Carnegie Hall, and suddenly the idea of Nonesuch Records hit me. Based upon experience I had as a youngster in Annapolis, Maryland, going to St. John's College and not being able to afford two records, only being able to buy one. They were $5.95 in those days. And so in 1963, I decided to create a label with a unique personality, all fustiness removed, that would issue the kinds of records that I loved when I was going to school in my late teens and early 20s, and I called it Nonesuch. And it was an enormous success, so great a success that unlike most situations with record companies whereby the pop music subsidizes classics, at Elektra, it was Nonesuch that subsidized Elektra and permitted us to go out and make rock and roll records.
In 1970, your label, Elektra, merged with Warner and Atlantic. Why did you decide to merge?
In the early 70s, I could see that being good at A&R and being effective marketeers, which is really just the connection of something wonderful with an audience that might want to hear it, was not going to be enough. We were running into problems of smaller independent distributors throughout the country folding and going out of business and not paying us, and I recognized that we would have to control our own distribution if Elektra was to survive as a label. And so I began to have talks with friends of mine, Mo Austin at Warner Brothers and the Erdogan brothers at Atlantic, about perhaps moving Elektra into an orbit where the three of us would have a merger for purposes of distribution only. What happened was that the Warner Atlantic labels were taken over by what became Warner Communications. And I met with Steve Ross, who was the chairman who sat on top of the entire Warner Communications mini-empire to be. And I liked Steve enormously. And I thought he had a real vision for the company. And the ability to control our own distribution, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, was enormously attractive to me. And on top of that, Steve gave me an opportunity to use my love and knowledge of technology throughout the entire company. So it was an irresistible opportunity, and I went for it. And unlike most people who have ended up having latter-day regrets about the selling of their company, I never did. I had a wild and wonderful ride.
After 23 years with Elektra Records, in 1973, you decided to get out. You write, "My instinct was it's time to go." You weren't quite 42 at the time. Why did you give up the company?
A couple of reasons. When I had been growing up, I had seen a movie called Holiday with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. And part of the premise of this movie was that this Cary Grant character wanted to take time off at midlife to find out why he was doing what he was doing. And that was always a ruling image for me, so that was always in the back of my head. In 1968, I had found Maui, and the Cary Grant image came back again. But I think the most important reason was that I had had 7 or 8 phenomenal years from 1966 to 1973, and I could tell that I had enjoyed a phenomenal cycle, and that cycle was not likely to continue into the 70s. And I just did not want to preside over the company when the music was going to be far less interesting.
Are you glad you got out, or do you have regrets?
No, I'm glad I did what I did.
Now, what are you doing now?
Well, I've had an interesting career ever since leaving Elektra. I went to Hawaii and lived there for 8 years and was chief technologist of Warner Communications, and I was deeply involved with Warner's entry into the cable business, and I did the initial research and development for Warner's on behalf of Optical Disc, which later became Laserdisc and the CD. And I was later chairman of Panavision, which is the world's preeminent designer and builder of camera systems for motion picture and television cinematography. And I got involved in a bunch of companies. And about 5 years ago, I came back to the Warner Music Group, and I'm their chief technologist.
So it hasn't exactly been retirement.
Well, I had it easy for the 7 or 8 years I was in Hawaii, and I'll never retire. My mind is just too active, and I'm too curious as an individual. But as long as people are putting out decent music, I'll be listening to it. Although I think there's been a dearth of really good music over the last few years, and I think that's as a result of the changes and the differences between making records in the 60s and 70s and making records today, where the control of the industry is in the hands of fewer people.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Jack Holtzman founded Elektra Records. His new book is called Follow the Music. Here's another Elektra record by the late Phil Oakes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British Wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brother.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with one of the pioneers of split brain research, Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Lucinda Williams' new CD, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Can you really become more artistic by strengthening the right side of your brain? Probably not, according to neuroscientist Dr. Michael Gazzaniga. He's a pioneer of split-brain research and has mapped which parts of the left and right hemispheres perform certain functions. The people he studies for most of his split-brain research are epileptics who have had the connections between the left and right hemispheres of their brains severed in order to control seizures. Dr. Gazzaniga's new book, The Mind's Past, explores how the left hemisphere of the brain seems to act as the interpreter of our actions, forming the narrative explanations of why we do what we do. Dr. Gazzaniga is the director of the program in cognitive neuroscience at Dartmouth College. He says that of all the syndromes in neurology and of all the discoveries in brain science, none is more wondrous than studying people with split brains.
You wouldn't know a split brain if you had dinner with one. They're completely normal, completely seemingly integrated, one of the folks in every sense of the word. You really have to get into the laboratory and do lateralized testing techniques and all these things we do to show the differences between the hemispheres. And the reason is you've got this big dominant left hemisphere sitting there controlling the conversation, looking around the room, making sure information gets into its part of the brain. These patients are utterly normal in every sense of everyday life.
You've been studying split-brain patients now for, what, nearly 40 years?
That's correct.
How did you start studying split-brain patients?
Well, it was an opportunity given to me by my mentor, Roger Sperry, who then was a professor at Caltech, and the opportunity came up through the fact that a young neurosurgeon named Joseph Bogan had decided that the surgery could be very useful in the control of epilepsy. And they proceeded to carry out the surgery, which in effect is to disconnect the two half-brains from each other. And the idea was to keep if one hemisphere went into a seizure, the seizure activity would not spread to the other, and the patient would remain in control of their conscious function. And by and large, the surgery works, and it's continued to be used throughout the years. My own contribution to the work is to look at the psychological and basic neurologic result of that surgery.
So you've been studying basically behavior and cognition.
That's
by studying the split brain. What procedure do you use to study the difference between the left and the right brain and how they process information?
Sure. Well, it's actually very simple. If you fixate a point on the wall, just look at any point in space, it turns out that everything to the right of where you're looking is projected to your left brain exclusively, and everything to the left of where you're looking is projected to the right. So there are many devices one can build. It started off with just the basic tachistoscope, where you have someone fixate a point, and then you would flash information either to the left field or to the right field, and that would either go to the right brain or the left brain exclusively. And once the information was lateralized using that technique, you could then ask for what a particular hemisphere could do with that information. And then it turned out each hemisphere could do quite different things with it.
Let's start with the basics. What are some of the basic things that the left hemisphere can do that the right can't and vice versa?
Well, the left hemisphere is the hemisphere you don't want to leave home without. It's the one that has all the language processing capacities that you and I enjoy. It is the one that carries out most of the problem-solving activities that you and I are capable of. And the right hemisphere is specialized for another set of functions, the recognition of upright faces, attentional control mechanisms, and perhaps even monitors some of our emotional life in a specialized way. So they're quite different in what the two hemispheres do. Now, one of the things that gets picked up, of course, people talk about your left brain or your right brain or what have you, and those tend to be over-popularized extensions of the work. You have to remember that your brain and my brain is connected, so all of these functions are pooled together into what looks like our whole personhood.
So you don't recommend books like, what is it called, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain? It shows how you can strengthen your artistic abilities by strengthening the right side of your brain?
Well, that was an enthusiastic interpretation of the work. And actually that book has some well-known drawing techniques communicated that do help people learn to draw, but it doesn't have much to do with right or left brain processes.
Now, one of your theories is that the left side of the brain has a kind of interpreter in it. The left side of the brain makes sense of what we do, puts things into some kind of context, narrates our life as we live it. Tell us more about what the interpreter does.
Well, we discovered this actually a number of years after carrying out these studies. We sort of sat around the lab one day and asked, what does the left hemisphere think about all these things that we can get the right hemisphere to do? What does a split-brain patient, how does it deal with the behaviors that we can trigger from the silent right hemisphere? And so what we did was set up a simple experiment where to the left brain and the left brain only, we showed a picture of a chicken. And we had in front of the patient four choices, one of which was a chicken claw. And to the right brain at the same time, we showed a picture of a snow scene. And one of the four choices the right brain could pick was a picture of a snow shovel. And so we would flash these two pictures to the patient. And what would happen is the patient would point to the chicken claw because that goes with the chicken and the shovel because that went with the snow scene. But the left brain, the one we're talking to all the time, really only understands the chicken claw part of it. So there's the patient pointing with one hand to the chicken claw and the other hand is pointing to the shovel. And we just said, why are you doing that? And so the left hemisphere answers this and it says, oh, well, that's easy. The chicken claw goes with the chicken and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed. And the point being that the hemisphere immediately built up a story that made sense to explain a behavior that was coming out of his own body. And this interpretive function of the left hemisphere seems to be going on all the time. We're constantly trying to interpret and give meaning to behaviors that we engage in. And sometimes these behaviors come out before we really actually have a meaning for them. But the interpreter quickly lassos them in and builds them into why we did such a thing. And you see this very commonly in emotions, where there will be some quick metabolic change in us that either triggers an anxiety or triggers maybe a mood depression. And pretty soon the person is in there trying to come up with a theory as to why this occurred, when in fact the event could have been totally spurious. But the left brain won't leave us alone. It's constantly trying to construct a theory to explain our emotional states and our actual behavior.
I'm going to ask you to give another example of that, and that's the example of the test that you gave where you told somebody's right brain to take a walk.
Right. So here, in some of the patients, the right hemisphere can understand simple commands. And here's an example where we told one of the split-brain patients to take a walk. We told the right hemisphere to take a walk. And so the patient gets up away from the testing table and starts to leave the room, and we yelled after him, where are you going? And he looked around at us, and he quickly said, oh, I'm thirsty. I thought I'd go get a drink. And here again was a behavior triggered by his silent right hemisphere. His left hemisphere really didn't know why he was walking. But we instantly generate a theory to explain these quick changes in our behavior and our moods, so it doesn't look like we are a collection, a mosaic of independent units, that in fact we have a narrative center, a personhood, that we're in charge, that we're in charge of all these things. And in fact, there's many things we're not in charge of.
So sometimes this interpreter in the left brain is actually finding the truth, finding a narrative that is true, but sometimes it's just kind of rationalizing or trying to explain something, and it's getting it all wrong.
Well, that's right. The basic function of the interpreter is to get it all right. It's to try to explain how A relates to B. And in most instances, this is a very productive function, and in most instances, it can solve the problem correctly. But occasionally, actually quite commonly, it can mess things up and spin a story about the meaning of something when, in fact, there's really no meaning to the storyline at all.
Now, do you think that this connects at all with false memory, which is a really important social topic today and a very controversial one?
It sure is. It's a fascinating topic, and I think the interpreter is very, very involved in that process. What I think the left hemisphere does is stereotype. It takes a scene and it says, okay, this is let's say it's a picture of a schoolhouse. Here's a schoolhouse. And a little while later, you're asked about the picture, and you're asked if a particular item was in the picture. Well, your left brain said, well, it was a schoolhouse. They're asking me about a billboard. There must, a chalkboard. There must have been a chalkboard in the picture. And they say, yes, of course, there was a chalkboard in the picture. And because that it has a high probability of being right, we are comfortable with the result. And yet one can do these things experimentally and show there was no chalkboard in the picture whatsoever. So what the left hemisphere does is it tries to grasp the overall context of a scene. It stores it that way. And then when asked about it later, it will include all kinds of things that could have been in such a picture and come to believe that they actually were. The right hemisphere doesn't do that. We can test, of course, the right hemisphere separately in these patients. When you do the same sort of test with the right hemisphere, it just gives the information right back to you. It doesn't do any of the interpretation, doesn't do any of the expansion on the actual information given. It just sits there kind of like a tape recorder, and it indicates exactly what happened and exactly what didn't happen. The left hemisphere, just like you and I, are constantly embellishing past memories and expanding on them and creating a warehouse full of false memories.
Has this led you to any conclusions or theories about recovered memory and false memory?
Well, this is a very active area of research carried out by many people, and there is no question that one can produce false memories. One can do it in the laboratory on a regular basis. And that's not to say that there aren't memories of traumatic memories from the past that are true. The question here is really the quality of the evidence that a particular event happens. It is so easy to bring out a false recollection in somebody that one simply needs several points of information about the past to verify a claim of an event. You can't go on one person's testimony. It's just too dangerous.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Michael Gazzaniga. He's a neuroscientist and the author of the new book, The Mind's Past. He's been conducting research about the brain and the split brain for nearly 40 years. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about your research. This is Fresh Air. Back with neuroscientist Dr. Michael Gazzaniga. He's been conducting research on the left and right hemispheres of the brain for close to 40 years. His latest book is called The Mind's Past. You're one of the neuroscientists who pioneered research on the two different hemispheres of the brain. There's a lot of pop psychology that's happened since to describe the two hemispheres of the brain and to help us strengthen them and so on. What do you think are some of the popular beliefs that may actually just be myths?
Well, there are people who seemingly work at a more intuitive level. There are people who are super rational. And people will say, okay, the super rational person is left brain, the intuitive person is right brain. What's unfortunate is that there are those two styles of people. There's no question about that. To give it a false anatomy or a false neuroscientific basis is to miss the point. And I don't know. I think it's at the level, most of these things are at the level of the humorous New Yorker cartoon and aren't really things that should drive one's research program. When you actually get down to the basic data, like we've been talking about, you do have this very inventive, smart left hemisphere, and you do have this rather copycat, veridical right hemisphere. That's true. That's the way the brains are built. But in you and I, they're hooked together. They're absolutely hooked together. So that's not a way to think about how you and I are behaving. Yet there are these overriding styles. So people use this sort of shorthand neuroscience to talk that way. And you know, I guess it's fun, and I don't think about it too much.
So if I'm a really rational person, it's not because I have a bigger or stronger left hemisphere of my brain.
No.
And because both hemispheres of my brain are connected,
right,
they're working together, and it doesn't matter which is stronger. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, it turns out the networks that are allow you to be rational are in your left hemisphere. All the data seems to point to that. And it turns out that those neural systems that allow you to recognize unfamiliar faces from a lineup, that seems to be a right hemisphere function. Those are a set basis of truths. But that what you're saying when someone is rational versus when somebody's intuitive, you don't know where you are on this little left-right dichotomy thing. And my guess is that a intuitive person is also using their left hemisphere madly, wildly, more outside of their conscious control than the average person. It's not that it's going on in the right hemisphere.
One of the things you've been interested in is how the brain's ability to learn and to remember changes with age. And I'm wondering if you see any changes in yourself as you get older.
Oh, God, yes. I have two children, 10 and 12, and in a second family, and I wouldn't be so acutely aware of this if I didn't have these children, who are these little tape recorders running around the house remembering every event as it literally occurs, and how my wife and I have come to embellish on the events and to change its meaning and so forth. And there's no question that there are changes. The basic thing that is understood is, again, that we confuse our sources of information. We'll tend to remember the gist of something, but we'll forget where we heard it, that kind of thing. Or we'll incorporate too much into the narrative what actually happened. Because of this left hemisphere's need to get a narrative, to get a stereotype going so you can sort of capture the situation and go on and deal with the next piece of information. As we age and as adults, we do that, you know, with reckless abandon, and that leads to these memory problems that we have. I actually like them, though.
No, as I recall, you say in your book that proper nouns are often the first thing to go, the names of things.
That's true. That's just a clinical fact, and this anomia for specific things is probably related to the beginning of the degenerative process that occurs to the brain, where cells are lost and somehow that it is believed, although there's no mechanism here worked out that truly explains this, it is believed that somehow correlates with the increasing anomia, as it's called, the inability to get a name.
And if you have that, as so many people seem to, does that mean that you should brace yourself for worse memory losses to come?
Well, no. I mean, it hits pretty soon after 50. And I think it's just a device that people are aware of, and you'll see greater note-taking in people, and you'll see that the little props they'll use to try to remember so-and-so's name and that kind of thing. But no, the capacity for liquid intelligence, for problem solving, remains fairly well intact, and that's the important thing. If you can solve a problem and can't quite remember the name that you should apply to the task at hand, that's sort of a secondary issue, and I don't think one that should be that frightening.
Since you've hit upon this theory of the left hemisphere of the brain having an interpreter within it who tries to make sense of things, and the sense that it makes isn't always accurate, are you less trustful of your own perceptions of things and your own understanding of things? Do you often think, well, this is a reflex to make sense of things, but what I'm thinking isn't necessarily the truth? It's not necessarily accurate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what keeps you awake at night, is the belief that you've missed something here. And the beauty of science, of course, is that you have the duty and the responsibility to go back into the lab and test it from another direction to make sure you've got it right. And the beauty of, and the reason scientists sometimes are unhappy with the humanists and what have you, is that they too will generate a theory about something, but in fact they don't have the tools to see which of these truths is actually true, which of these claims is actually true. So one of the blinding aphrodisiacs of science is that you can go check yourself. And even when you check, you still wake up the following week worried about that, and you go back and forth and back and forth. So, yes, it's the fact that you may be wrong is what motivates you to keep going and to constantly check and recheck ideas. And it's not uncommon that you have to, if you don't junk them, someone next door figures out how to junk them, and you have to respond to it and try to see who, in fact, is right.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Gazzaniga directs the program in cognitive neuroscience at Dartmouth College. His new book is called The Mind's Past. Coming up, a long-awaited new CD by Lucinda Williams. This is Fresh Air. Lucinda Williams' new album, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, was 6 years in the making. Williams' well-publicized perfectionism and numerous changes of producers and record labels led to her long absence from the recording scene. But rock critic Ken Tucker says the results have been well worth the wait.
Not a day goes by, I don't think about you. You left your mark on me, it's permanent, a tattoo. Pierce the skin and the blood runs through. Oh, my baby. The way you move is right.
It's the weathered, world-weary tone of Lucinda Williams' voice that both inspires devotion among her fans and indifference among the mass pop audience. That, for example, preferred Mary Chapin Carpenter's tidy rendition of Williams' Passionate Kisses to Williams' earthier own version. Lucinda Williams takes pride in fashioning rough-hewn music, perfectly realized stuff that sounds as if it had just been dashed off. That's the trick she's always trying to pull off, and on Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, she does the trick almost every time.
He had a reason to get back to Lake Charles. He used to talk about it. He'd just go on and on. He always said Louisiana was where.
Lucinda Williams has a lot of stories like this to tell. Tales of guys or girls who don't fit into the world, despite charm, talent, and a knack for breaking hearts. Sometimes you get the feeling she's writing about herself, even when, as on that song, Lake Charles, she's writing about a guy she used to date. At the very least, she has a genius for recognizing soulmates in bad luck, and the sort of stubbornness that makes for doomed relationships.
This world divides us. Two different sides, but this wall's not real. How can it be real? It's only made of concrete and barbed wire. Concrete and barbed wire. Concrete and barbed wire. It's only made of concrete and barbed wire.
Rock critics are always reminding people that Williams is the daughter of a poet and teacher, Miller Williams, and that despite the romance of the road image she cultivates, Lucinda has an academic understanding of lyric writing that few singer-songwriters possess. But one of the great strengths of her writing is that it never sounds academic or fussy the way the music of, say, Nancy Griffith or, well, Mary Chapin Carpenter's does. The title song of this album tells a whole short story of a life, sketched in quick details that never get in the way of the music.
Sitting in the kitchen, the house of Macon, Loretta singing on the radio. Smell of coffee, eggs and bacon, car wheels on a gravel road. Outside, somebody somewhere don't know. Come on now, child, we're gonna go for a ride. Car wheels on a gravel road.
I don't hear this album as Williams' commercial breakthrough, much as her latest label, Mercury, may be banking on it. What makes Williams' music so compelling, the way it falls between the cracks of rock and roll, country, blues, and folk, is what dooms it as radio programming. But no one who makes music as passionate and precise as this is ever going to lack for a nurturing audience. Join the Lucinda Williams cult today and help keep this stuff coming, no matter how long it takes her to come up with it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Lucinda Williams' new CD is called Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Kathy Wolf, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
So bad, I know it couldn't be, but I want what we had. I know our love is gone, and I can't bring it back. Still I long for your kiss. Still I long for your kiss.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.